From the top players and legends to the very best analysts around the world, from wherever the beautiful game is played, this is BTP. Now, we're talking football.
Welcome, everyone, to another episode of Beyond the Pitch. I'm Juan Arango, and it's a pleasure to be with you. And it's a pleasure to have with me none other than man that really, if you were on Twitter or any type of social media the past, I don't know, 6 months, 7 months, maybe even more, he's really kept you on edge. You know, his tweets were pretty much the equivalent of many kind of mystery. You know, it's kind of like scandal and, some type of political drama all mixed in one. It's Mr. Ken Benzinger. How you doing, sir? And first of all, congratulations on your book. It's coming out in the next couple of weeks on June 12th. I know that because that's when I'm heading to work up duties. It's called Red Card: How the U.S. Blew the Whistle on the World's Biggest Sports Scandal. Welcome to the show, sir. How's everything?
Oh, things are great, Juan. Thanks so much for having me and give me the opportunity to talk about my book.
What, look, the first question is, what's not to know about your book? Because I'll start out with a little bit. The reason why I was so intrigued about it is because the FIFA Gate story itself was funny, because I happened to be working for a project that was being done for a regional organization that was looking to set up their own channel. 3 a.m., I get a call, hey, check out the TV. And you see all the leaders, all the presidents of the region being arrested back in 2015, Eduardo Lee and a whole host of others. And I'm like, oh, I have no work. That was pretty much my, you know, that was pretty much my recollection. And then having to be in front of the CONCACAF offices while the FBI is going in, it was a really strange day. How did that story end up affecting you, or end up bringing you, reeling you in to this whole investigation, everything that ensued?
I recall that day as well. My background is as an investigative reporter, and not necessarily specifically about soccer or about sports in general. More is one of the things I've dipped my toes into from time to time throughout my career on different sports topics. And I was working for a number of years at the LA Times and then jumped to work for BuzzFeed News. And my editor there gave me a chance to take a swing at a big sports story. And prior to the last World Cup, just a few days before it started, I published a story about Chuck Blazer, who's a figure people who follow the sport probably recall from a few years back. He turns out to have been this enormously corrupt figure, and I did what was probably the most in-depth profile of him at that time, looking at sort of his career and how he came up in the sport and how he did good things for the sport, but how he also skimmed literally tens of millions of dollars from the sport and did all kinds of unsavory things. And that ran then in 2014, and a year later, when you were terrified about your future and what was going to happen to the sport when everyone was getting carted off to jail, my phone was blowing up, because what we found out around the same time was that one of the central informants in the entire case that the Department of Justice had made, the guy who was wearing a wire for a big chunk of the time, was in fact Chuck Blazer. And sort of overnight, I'd become the de facto expert on one of the central guys in this story that for a time it was the only story anyone in the world was talking about. And so within a short period of time, I just had a lot of opportunity from people who wanted me to spend time and learn more. And I'd always wanted to write a book. And so I talked to my editors and I did a gut check and talked to my wife and decided to do it, and leapt in and decided to immerse myself in the world of soccer and try to tell the complete story of that criminal case, which I think changed the face of the sport forever.
It's interesting you say gut check and delve in. I mean, the times that you've kind of had to go up to the surface and catch a breath to go back in, how have you been able to have that step outside and say, okay, wow, this is crazy, before you have to go delve back in and continue looking at a different aspect of the story that you've been following for a few years now? Is that the case, or is it now that you're like, you know, this is just how football's run around the world? Or is it something that you've become normalized, or was it something that you saw as normal operation as you continued to investigate?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that came out of this case, and I will tip my hat to the work that U.S. investigators did to really look at the way the sport operated from the highest sort of highest levels of Zurich in the airiest, loftiest halls of FIFA headquarters, all the way down to sort of the grittiest little local level of the sport throughout the world. What they uncovered was that that to a greater or lesser extent, the opportunity for corruption is there almost at every level. And that's disheartening and depressing. And it also speaks, I think, in a sense, to human nature more than anything else. It's just that when something is as big and as important and as beloved as soccer, the opportunity for people to take advantage of that for their benefit is huge. And the opportunistic nature of human beings in general, of all of us, shows its true colors in those conditions. So I'm thinking now of something that came out in sort of the more recently, earlier this year, in the case, the FIFA case we've all followed, was a less noticed thing, but I thought it was sort of reflective of the way the sports problems persist. So, you know, we knew about the big corruption with the voting for the World Cup, and we've heard about some of the big rights deals that were corrupt and bribes were paid, but there was a Panamanian company that pled guilty a few months ago, and what it pled guilty to was essentially bribing Eduardo Lee, who you mentioned earlier, not a giant amount of money, but sort of a middling amount of money, in order for Costa Rica to change the uniform equipment supplier for the Costa Rican national team. And for years, they'd been wearing Lotto, and in a sort of a complicated bribe scheme, they ended up paying him a few hundred thousand dollars to switch the national team to New Balance, right? And I think in the grand scale of things, it's pretty trivial whether Costa Rica wears Lotto or New Balance. And to me, the bigger takeaway from that story was that this kind of thing is perhaps, you know, everywhere. Another thing that comes to mind is I remember doing some research that didn't really end up in the book, but looking at AYSO, which is, you know, the beloved America Youth Soccer Organization, founded out here in California, where I live, and that is a big pipeline for youth talent in this country, and just also for getting kids into the sport. I was looking at old newspaper clips from the early 80s, and there's all these AYSO coaches getting arrested and getting prosecuted because they were skimming off the AYSO till, right? I mean, parents were putting in their money for their kids to play.
Yeah.
And the treasurer of the local, you know, Pasadena AYSO or something was skimming tens of thousands of dollars from the AYSO. So it's sad to say, but there is something about soccer and also sports in general that lends itself to that kind of problem.
It's funny you mentioned that whole AYSO thing. That happened down here too with a couple of back in the late 80s and I believe early 90s, that occurred, that a couple of high level officials of AYSO ended up, you know, being accused. I don't recall what ended up happening there, but it's interesting that corruption is pretty much so prevalent everywhere. I mean, even at the most innocent or youth, you know, type levels, you see that, you know, I mean, wherever big business has really become prevalent, that's where you start to see where these issues, you know, start to arise. I mean, the money's there, the access is there.
That's right. I mean, I think it speaks a little bit, well, I mean, it's a little bit, I think, I know, I do this book, I spent a lot of time thinking about the way that prosecutors think and what they have to deal with. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, one is that if you spend time doing that, you start to see that sort of a black spot in the heart of every man, perhaps. But also, I think that one of the things about corruption is that sort of, you know, evil is in the eye of the beholder. I think that most corrupt people don't even think of themselves as corrupt, but there's always a way to justify, or almost always a way to justify your behavior. We've all done a few things in our lives that we felt bad about immediately or even beforehand, and we did it anyway, and we knew it was bad. But we've also done things that we didn't even think about as being bad until later. And I think one of the ways that something like deeply entrenched soccer corruption happens is that it's little by little and gradual, and you think it's the way business is done, and you don't even stop to consider that might not be okay. And I think you start out with a little bribe, just a little money here. Maybe they give you a ticket to a match, and then they give you a couple of bucks, and then they give you more and more, and all of a sudden you're demanding $1 million to get in exchange for a contract. And by that time you're in so deep, and all your friends are in the same way, you've forgotten
the reason why originally. You know,
exactly. Exactly.
I mean, those, you know, usually those good intentions, I mean, usually those corrupt, you know, actions end up, you know, being a byproduct of innocent and good intentioned actions. I mean, as crazy as naive it might sound.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that's right. You know, I mean, I think that a lot of the people who ended up corrupting the sport thought of it, thought about the good of the sport. I mean, sort of the you know, the person who was at the beginning of all that was João Havelange, the Brazilian president of FIFA for many years. And when he came in, he really wanted to grow the sport around the world. And this is a man who was the first non-European, in fact, the only non-European to ever be president of FIFA. And he said, I want the rest of the world to play this sport. And he had these great ambitions that people in all kinds of countries that really didn't have the resources to play the sport would get the opportunity. And the problem was that costs a lot of money to bring sport to sub-Saharan Africa, to bring it to places in Southeast Asia, to bring it to Pacific Islands. These places require resources. And he realized they didn't have the resources. And the need for the resources to get the sport everywhere meant he had to turn to commercial partners. And that once he begins commercializing the sport to the big brands of the world, that's when funny things start happening. And when all of a sudden people start realizing they can personally make money as well. And it's a downward spiral from there, I think.
Oh yeah, of course. You know, when your pockets start getting lined up as well as, you know, the pockets of the charity or the organization. I mean, yeah, that's why you see so many people go to jail, you know, years afterwards because of that. Throughout your investigation, what was like the craziest thing you heard that you say, oh my god, you know, what did I get myself into as far as investigating this? Was there ever a moment that you just like, you know, guys, I don't know what I got myself into, but damn, this is worse than I even thought?
Well, I mean, there was definitely moments where the depths of the corruption were more shocking than I could have imagined, and the amount of betrayals. I've done other types of investigation where I personally have felt like my own safety might be at risk. I didn't feel that way that much on this book. It tended to be more of a problem of people slamming the door very, very firmly in my face. And so there was, I spent, gosh, well over a year just being rejected by everyone and no one would tell me anything useful. And I traveled quite a bit just getting nowhere and feeling frustrated. And there was a low point, which was when I flew to New York for, it must have been the 15th time, to meet this important source who I got off the airplane, was walking through the airport, and this source said, you know what, I'm not going to meet with you, sorry. And I just thought at that point, I will never, ever crack the code on this. I'll never get through. And so there was lots of moments like that. But then there were these moments, finally, where things started to break through and rays of sunshine came through that felt great and rewarding and also shocking. I learned from some great sources about inside stories of different ways that people were arrested. And one of my favorite stories took place in Miami, where this is a story that's in the book. It hasn't ever been told anywhere. Glad to share it with you guys, which is how the feds arrested Jack Warner, his children. So Jack Warner was this notoriously corrupt president of CONCACAF and a FIFA vice president. In fact, he was the longest serving FIFA vice president and true global power broker in soccer. And he also happened to be a government minister in Trinidad, which meant he was an international diplomat, traveled in a diplomatic passport, and you can't just arrest someone like that. But he had a vulnerability, which is he had two sons who were also involved in criminal behavior. And they weren't diplomats, and so the feds staged an elaborate arrest of Warner's sons in their penthouse condo in Miami, in front of their father. So they found out when Warner was going to be in town for something, and his sons were going to be in his town as well. And they came at 6 a.m. Knocked on the door, went in there, and in front of Jack Warner, handcuffed and arrested his sons in the hopes that that would convince him to buckle and agree to cooperate with their investigation. But maybe the most amazing revelation out of that story is that Jack Warner looked the feds in the face, and he didn't blink. He said, no, take my sons if you have to, but I'm not saying a word. And he didn't. And it's pretty, to me, it was an incredible testament to the kind of willpower and confidence and political savvy it takes to become a Jack Warner. I mean,
even now, I mean, he's still been battling the U.S. government for extradition when still being in Trinidad, and there's nothing that can be done in that aspect, or nothing that can really be be done in a more efficient or quick manner as far as that's concerned. We're with Ken Benzinger here on Beyond the Pitch. He's the author of the book that just is coming out on June 12th, Red Card, How the U.S. Blew the Whistle on the World's Biggest Sporting Scandal. And it's interesting you always mention Miami because, I don't know, that's just, you know, people talk about tourism being the biggest industry for Miami. I'm like, no, it's bootleggery. It used to be a pirate cove. It used to be a place where, you know, rum was being brought in from the Caribbean, and during Prohibition, you know, you had the guys from the, you know, I mean, that's pretty much what Miami's been made out of, even going back to the days of the pirates running around the Caribbean. But Miami always seems to be in the center, and in Miami, not the exception to the rule in terms of this whole FIFAGate scandal and how everything comes out.
No question about that. I mean, I want to jump in to say that, you know, when I started this book, I kind of imagined traveling to Brazil and to Switzerland and to London and to New York, and I did all that. Mm-hmm. But everywhere I went, people said, "Have you been to Miami? Have you been to Miami?" And finally, I went to Miami. And once I went once, I had to keep coming back. I think I went to Miami 6 times to report on this book. Mm-hmm. And I at one point I had a fare alert on my email, and I would just get pinged by nonstop cheap fares from Los Angeles, where I live, to Miami. And I'd get a fare, and I'd say to my wife, "Look, it's $190 round trip. I'm going, see you." And I'd just go to the airport and go to Miami. Yeah. And because it always paid off. It always paid off. And so much happened in Miami that it was just it was almost impossible not to walk down the street and find out something else about the case. Many of the people in the case either lived in Miami or spent a lot of time in Miami, and many of the dirty deals were cooked up in exclusive restaurants in Miami Beach and in and all the different places facing the ocean down in Miami. So it was essential and really at the heart of it all.
Yeah, and it was funny because not obviously related to the case. I mean, there's been coaching signings that have occurred at malls here in Miami. I mean, Jose Pickerman, when he finally signed on to become the Colombian national team coach, he was pretty much meeting up at Aventura Mall with the president, the then president Luis Bedoya, who actually is in prison right now. He was one of those guys. He's finally signed with the Colombian national team, pretty much in a mall here in Miami.
I think that's where people go to make their deals in soccer. I mean, actually, one of the biggest planned operations within the criminal case that I'm talking about in this book took place in Miami in Aventura. There was a press conference for the Copa America Centenario, mm-hmm. On May 1st, 2014. And the feds planned an elaborate thing where they had people wearing wires all over the place. And they were recording everyone because they realized that an event in Miami would draw these people from all over the world to come and talk about football. And they could get them at these restaurants and cafes and bars and record them. And that's what they did. And there was no other place they could think of in the Americas where they could get more people together and more corrupt soccer officials in one room.
Well, hey, we got to be famous for something, right? I mean, the data that happened, everything that was being mentioned, Ken, to be honest with you, all of a sudden it was in Miami. Oh, yeah, you know, traffic. The offices from CONCACAF had recently moved, with that group of individuals that was running the organization then. And pretty much networks and all other types of you know, lawyers and businessmen and what have you, they all had an office down here. It was the most amazing thing ever because every single news story and every reporter was being contacted to do one single story or at least one single story on that whole case. We all happened to be here.
Right. Right. No, I mean, that's right, because traffic was there, but it wasn't just traffic. There were other, there was Media World and other companies that were involved in the buying and selling of rights, and CONCACAF had moved its offices to Miami from New York, mm-hmm. Under that once Blazer, I mentioned earlier, was out. The new people running it were in Miami, and it was just a focal point of all that. And as you said, whenever a South American wanted to make a deal, unless they were from their same country, the sort of neutral meeting point was Miami, right? And there was in the trial in this case that finally happened late last year, there was documented, you know, surveillance of these meetings happened in Miami as well. Different restaurants where they would meet and discuss deals and how they all use Miami banks, right? Like the banks that they all use to make these transfers all had branches in Miami. So, you know, it's apparently the center of the soccer world is Miami. Just FYI, everyone.
I didn't say that, so people don't, you know, I didn't tell you to say that. That's you saying it on your own. Ken, out of all the personalities that you reported on or did research upon, which one was the most, let me see, for lack of a better term, I'll make one up, you know, godfatherish, if you will, in terms of how he managed himself?
I know your question. The answer is an easy one. He's no longer on this mortal coil anymore. He passed away in 2014. But Julio Humberto Grondona from Argentina was essentially like the central casting Hollywood movie of the Godfather figure. He carried himself like a gangster. He kind of looked like a gangster. And he conducted his whole business in a way that seemed modeled after like Hollywood representations of, you know, mafia behavior. I mean, I gathered stories of how he would meet people to make corrupt deals in this scary gas station he owned in like one of the worst neighborhoods outside of Buenos Aires, right? He would make these people come to this gas station. They would sit in this tiny office where no one was around, just a single light bulb dangling from the ceiling. And he would sit there with a gold chain around his neck and his hair slicked back. And he had this gold ring he wore all the time that said "Todo pasa," and which it's a widely translatable term, but it, you know, it can mean anything can happen or everything passes, like everything ends eventually. And the ambiguity of the term is, I think, appropriate for him because it sort of means I'm the guy in control around here. And he would cook up these deals and he would make careers and destroy careers. And he had, over the years, just a series of people who were kind of his valets who would take care of deals for him and kind of live off the things he would spread their way. And that one of the famous stories came out that he was offered the job of being president of CONMEBOL, excuse me. And he turned it down because he felt that he would lose influence and power by taking that. He liked the free agency of just running the Argentine Federation and of being the one of the vice presidents of FIFA, where he was Sepp Blatter's right-hand man.
It's interesting you mentioned that, him being Sepp Blatter's right-hand man. He literally and figuratively was, and in some cases, Grondona, and I was trying to, you know, I thought Godfather because of just this, you know, being above the law type of, you know, example, and you're absolutely right. Those stories that even when he was so powerful that when he went to FIFA, the official language of the organization would change to Spanish.
Yeah, he famously wouldn't learn any other languages, and everyone else, I mean, almost everyone with FIFA at least speaks some English and a few languages, and he refused to speak any other languages. He just wouldn't do it and stood out because of that. And he also was famous for very off-colored public remarks about English people, about Jewish people, about American people. Argentina, as many will know, had a war with England in the early 80s over these islands off the coast of Argentina that are British territories. Excuse me. The Argentines called them the Malvinas, and the English called them the Falklands, and England, with its military might, won the war. So when England was trying to get the World Cup to host it in 2018, which of course ended up going to Russia, England's bid asked Grondona what it would take to get him to vote for them. And he said, if you give us back the Malvinas, we'll vote for you. And it was sort of a typical kind of thing. He also said he wouldn't vote for the American bid for 2022 because they were too friendly with the English. He was famous for making comments about Jewish referees. I mean, and how they were too lazy to be good referees. He was really a sweet, sweet, sweet human being. And I'm being very sarcastic. I mean, he was by all accounts just a really nasty, conniving, tough SOB, but also an incredible survivor. This is a guy who became the head of Argentine's Soccer Association in 1979 and stayed in that post until he died. A period of time that saw them go from a dictatorship when he took over, it was a military dictatorship, to a transition to democracy, and then through very radically gyrating economic ups and downs that poor country suffers, And everything in that country is always changing, but he never did. He was the constant thing and the ultimate survivor. And because he was the head of the finance committee at FIFA, that also meant he controlled FIFA's purse strings. So you can imagine the influence he had. So truly one of the most incredible characters in the whole saga.
Yeah.
But he's not alone. I mean, I should say there's a lot, you know, Jeffrey Webb is quite a character. He was the president of CONCACAF, and he came up from sort of almost nowhere. When Jack Warner, was pushed out, over his own scandals, Jeff Webb, who was sort of an unknown banker from the Cayman Islands, suddenly convulsed into power in CONCACAF. And his entire
that alone should have been a kind of a red flag, right? A banker from the Cayman Islands.
Yeah, right. I mean, come on. But he got the job, and you know, this is a guy who never played the sport. Which, but you know, I don't think that's a problem. Some people hate that, but I think that's fine. But you know, hadn't been hugely political either, and all of a sudden he's in this position, and his entire campaign was based on him saying, "I'm going to clean things up, and I'm about reform and cleanliness, and this is a new." Clean day. And maybe it was like that Shakespeare line, "Methinks the lady doth protest too much." He turns out to be as dirty or dirtier than anyone else. Not only was he immediately skimming tons of money from the sport and demanding huge, epic, maybe unprecedentedly large bribes for soccer rights, but it turns out he was being investigated by the police in the Cayman Islands for taking part in a massive corruption scheme that had nothing to do with soccer, but was scamming the public health system in the Cayman Islands. And his best friend, who was the treasurer of Cayman's Football Association, was brought down in that, in which they were stealing literally millions of dollars from the public in the Cayman Islands in a scam over a billing situation. So, you know, I mean, just dirty from top to bottom. And he would take the money that was sent as bribes to him and launder it through American banks and buy houses and pools and throw parties for himself. And famously, just a couple weeks before he ends up getting arrested in Zurich, he made his last big purchase, which is a fire engine red convertible Ferrari with a vanity license plate. He bought that on May 1st, 2015. And not even 4 weeks later, he was arrested.
That's crazy. And we're here with Ken Benzinger on Beyond the Pitch. Ken, we talk about, I don't know, especially with the climate here in the country, and I'm talking about other sports with the NFL, especially the NFL, and to another extent, the NBA as well. You hear a lot of people saying, well, you know, we shouldn't mix sport with, you know, politics or with, you know, this or with that. We shouldn't mix those two. But there's been a lot of mixing, I mean, throughout history. I mean, you have to go back even as early as the 1910s and the 1920s when Brazil was becoming more integrated and you first started to see, you know, Afro-Brazilians become rather prevalent in on their national team and in at the professional levels. In 1930s when Mussolini becomes so important as far as you know, the Italian national team winning 2 World Cups during that time. How, I mean, in today's environment with the World Cup bids going on, how much is politics right now being a major influence or a major player in terms of the, you know, of how things are going on in terms of the bid? I mean, obviously politics has a lot to do with it. Sport has a lot to do with it. And of course, both of them have little tinges of corruption still, some larger than others, of course. But how is that really becoming an influence as far as the development of television rights, of World Cup bids, things of that nature?
The sort of the relationship between soccer and politics?
Yeah, especially here in the United States. How are you seeing that, I guess, evolve to another level? Or a different level, if you will, especially with the World Cup bids here in the United States.
Yeah, I mean, look, you know, FIFA makes a point of things of saying it's a non-political organization, and that all the different associations that radiate below it are supposed to be non-political. Obviously, we know that's not true, right? We know that even if organizations aren't officially associated with governments, their governments in many countries play a big role in operations of sport on all kinds of levels, both the most local to international. So, you know, we've seen that World Cup bidding, the way that countries lobby. And that sports ministers and that kind of stuff communicate their desires and wishes for the sport. And I think the U.S. traditionally has been pretty good about keeping out of it because if for nothing else, because mostly traditionally American politicians don't care enough about soccer to really stick their nose in it and mess with it. But I think that has been changing. I think we started to see that a little bit change with the U.S. bid for the failed U.S. bid for 2022 when you had the honorary chairman of the bid, the former U.S. president, Bill Clinton, right? And you had people involved in that who had political heft and had direct relationships with current administration officials and that kind of stuff. So the line started to get a little bit blurred. And now, you know, the current U.S. bid, we've seen the current sitting president, Donald Trump, actually both tweet and make public comments and speeches about the U.S. Mexico-Canada United bid and how he wants countries around the world to support it. Well, that, you know, when he says countries around the world, he means the FIFA voters. And his at least two comments on the thing actually led drew a soft rebuke from FIFA, reminding him of their ethics code. So, you know, that's an example actually of a very direct political involvement in the process in a way that's never happened in this country before. You know, and I think that's kind of unprecedented, and I don't know what that means. I don't think it's necessarily a great sign. When it comes to broadcasting and that kind of stuff, I think that it's a little harder to put your finger on it. But when you have these massively powerful and important broadcasters like Fox controlling or ESPN controlling soccer rights and vying for them, and the fact that they also have ongoing relationships with the government and different things they do. I mean, Fox is trying to sell a big chunk of itself to Disney, and is awaiting, you know, approval from the DOJ. These things get so intermingled, it's hard to really separate them. And now in this country and in the future, I think we'll see more and more intermingling of politics and soccer.
And it's interesting you mentioned that the U.S. bid and I don't know, even the Morocco bid to a certain extent. The mention of, oh, well, let's not make it about geopolitics, but a lot of times they do make it about geopolitics, because if you look at the Qatar bid, one of the biggest knocks it had was, you know, the human rights records that were in Qatar at that moment, or even to this day. I mean, you could even make that argument as well. The allegations of what's going on. I mean, at this point, it's, I guess, the arguments and the debates in terms of what is acceptable and what is not has kind of taken pretty much a point of no return. I mean, you can't go and talk about, oh, you know, everything's beautiful, everything's great, without somebody rebuking and saying, you know what? No, it's not, because you have this problem, you have that problem, you have this and that and the other. So, I mean, have you seen that whole issue of World Cup bids already having to face some type of geopolitical, socioeconomic type of issues that have to be endured because of a World Cup bid process that's going up against two different nations or two different parties?
Yeah, I mean, I think absolutely this current bidding situation is a great example of that, right? I mean, you know, Morocco versus U.S., Canada, Mexico. I mean, a very stark difference, very contrasting kinds of bids, right? The U.S. is the world's largest economy. Canada is, it's got to be top 10, and Mexico right around there too. And so, you know, we're talking three massive economies versus Morocco, which last time I checked has an economy significantly smaller than that of Angola, right? So we're not talking about economic equals or political equals in terms of influence, but we are, you know, seeing Morocco get a fair chance and on its fourth, this is its fourth attempt to get the World Cup. I think there's a degree of desperation that they have to get it, that they seem willing to do what seems like, you know, anything to get it. And so there's an effort kind of to paint Morocco as going renegade and trying to buy influence and trying to pressure countries into voting for it. And the U.S. has been a little more careful about that, but we actually see other ways that maybe it has had influence. I mean, the feeling is that in Zurich, in the high levels of FIFA, they want it to go to the United bid. Now, is that because they think it's better for the sport? Perhaps. Although, you know, there's a lot of good arguments why Morocco would be a great place for a World Cup. But it might also be because those people in FIFA recognize the influence that the U.S. has both economically and politically. And, you know, I think that this criminal investigation, which I've written about, which we've all thought about so much, has to play some kind of role in this, even if it's just subconscious. I mean, if you, you know, a lot of people in FIFA believe incorrectly, in my opinion, very much incorrectly, mm-hmm. that the U.S. criminal investigation is a vendetta against FIFA for not awarding the World Cup to the U.S. That's just not the case. But I think because people in Zurich believe that, it can shade the way they think about other stuff. And so, you know, the Gianni Infantinos of the world, that kind of stuff, might be quaking in their boots that American prosecutors are going to come after them even harder. And the last thing they want to do is upset the Americans more. And so I think they feel not just economic pressure, but also sort of the fear of retribution or reckoning if they don't give the U.S. what it wants. So that's kind of a soft influence of these kind of political government moves that we might see reflected in FIFA decisions going forward.
But have you seen any type of, let me see, have you seen any type of inclination or, you know, type of tendency, especially with the new administration in the United States, that they would go after another government or another FA, if you will, or another individual if the U.S. doesn't get it? Or was that something more that you saw in the previous presidential administration where there was a willingness to clean up, but then there also, you know, might have been or, you know, possibly could have been or speculated that there was some type of vendetta?
So to clear it up, I want to be crystal clear.
Yeah.
In all my reporting, I saw zero evidence that there was any vendetta from the Obama administration about the World Cup bid. Remember that Obama had also backed the Chicago to get the Olympic Games. Chicago's his hometown, and the U.S. didn't get it, and there was questions about that as well. And we didn't see a subsequent investigation of the IOC from the U.S. And you would think that if there was a question of sour grapes, we would have come from the White House down, we would have been more likely to see an Olympics-related investigation than FIFA. I mean, you know, soccer is not known to be Obama's favorite sport. So I know how the investigation began, and it has nothing to do with that. So, you know, I will take every opportunity I can to dispel the commonly held myth that that's what happened.
Yeah, now, that's exactly it. It's a myth for the most part. It wasn't that, you know, the U.S. is trying to get back, or England's trying to get back, or anyone's trying to get back at anybody.
Well, you remember, I mean, I remember this, I looked it up, like the New York Times, which does a lot of soccer coverage now, and is allegedly the paper of record in this country, when the U.S. didn't get the bid in 2020, for 2022, when the election happened in December 2010, that story wasn't on the front page of the newspaper. In fact, it wasn't even on the front page of the sports section. The New York Times buried it inside their sports section. That's how important that news was in this country at the time. I think now it might be a front page story, but at the time it wasn't. There wasn't that interest. And so history makes people think that was a top-down vendetta, but it wasn't. Now, shifting to the current administration, trying not to be too political, I will say that we are seeing an unprecedented administration that does appear to believe that vendettas and taking revenge to people for slights or perceived slights is the way of doing business. And the comments Trump has made have stopped not very far shy of saying, of threatening the countries to vote for the U.S. I think one of his comments was, you know, to the countries of Africa, we have this bid, we hope you support it, and we'll be watching. Well, we'll be watching is kind of like, you know, you better stay in line, you better stay in your line, or you're in trouble. And that, you know, to me, reads as much more like a threat than anything we've ever seen out of any U.S. government when it comes to soccer stuff. And I think it's a little troubling. I mean, you know, I don't think it's good for the sport to have government officials messing around on it. And we've seen in other places. We saw in France, President Sarkozy messing around with what Platini was supposed to vote for back in 2010. And I think that's not good for the sport. And I think they should be separated.
And I mean, to piggyback on what you were just saying, I mean, just the comments, you know, we're recording on a Wednesday, you know, what the president said on Tuesday night, talking about, hey, we're going to build the wall and Mexico is going to pay for it. And they're going to like it. So, I mean, that too has to give a perception as well about the World Cup bid is not being too stable. Or then again, it's kind of, again, that separation between geopolitics and football politics. And again, they tend to really ride a very, very thin line.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, we see it less here in this country, right? Because because soccer is less important in the popular imagination in the U.S. than the NFL or basketball or baseball, we don't think of it the same way. But of course, anyone who's spent time in other countries understands how it's impossible to separate them. I brought up Argentina earlier in this conversation, but you know, the president of Argentina right now, so the president of a sovereign nation of 45 million people, got his start in soccer, and in probably his most prominent job prior to being president of the country was president of Boca Juniors, the most popular soccer club in Argentina. And that just seems like a cute anecdote, but it's really, to me, a telling thing about how important soccer is in countries like that, right?
It was a huge stepping stone from him. After then, he became the mayor of Buenos Aires, and then he becomes the president of Argentina. I mean,
that's right. I mean, he's not there without Boca. So, and I think lots of countries, we see that. I mean, soccer can be a springboard to political power or back from it. I mean, people indicted in the FIFA case were like that. The former president of Honduras, so another former country, after he was president of Honduras, became a high up and influential person in their soccer federation and ultimately was involved in corruption, indicted and convicted in the U.S. And a member of the Supreme Court of Guatemala, I believe, was also tied up in this. So you have actual political figures involved in all this kind of stuff and influencing political decisions. I mean, Jack Warner, again, it's impossible to separate his political career from his soccer career and vice versa. And the same skills that people like a Jack Warner developed being a populist politician in Trinidad also apply to the way that FIFA was run. I mean, it really was a deeply political organization. And the tools and the dirtiest bare knuckle tools of politics apply to the way soccer is run. I mentioned AYSO earlier. I think that even applies to big AYSOs. I mean, anyone who spent time involved in those knows that there's a political aspect of it to the sports operations.
Ken, we're talking here with Ken Benzinger here on Beyond the Pitch. Ken, as far as the transactions that occurred, one that I heard that was just absolutely crazy was that there were, you know, presidents of FAs in certain regions and certain here, especially here on the this side of the Atlantic, if you will, that during their regional, you know, their conferences, their congresses, they're talking about fishing trips to Mauritius, you know, those, really outrageously exotic things. I mean, it's not like you and I are going to get together and go and start saying, hey, you know what, why don't we can take that fishing trip over by the Great Barrier Reef? You know, it's something really crazy, you know, as far as vacations are concerned. You know, we'll probably go to a lake or something or a pond, you know, either here in Florida or in the Everglades or somewhere in a lake over up in California, not thinking Mauritius or trying to get a Ferrari. What was like the craziest transaction? I mean, you mentioned one with Jeffrey Webb and his red Ferrari, but which were some of the other ones that were just so crazy based on, and you start thinking, wait a second, the guy is running an FA in this country and it's pretty much been run to the ground, yet he has A, B, C, or D.
Yeah, I mean, in terms of the life of luxury and all that, it's an incredible catalog. I heard a story once that there was a event in, I think it was associated with the 2010 World Cup, and I think it was a Confederations Cup actually in 2009. In South Africa, and all the executive committee members were going down there, and there was an idea for them to have a party in a yacht, and then someone thought, well, why only one yacht? There's 24 members of the executive committee, and so the story goes that they got 24 yachts, one for every executive member of the executive committee, so they could each have their own yacht and wouldn't feel less than the other ones. Which that anecdote I love because it's so excessive. It's so unnecessary. I mean, these yachts are gigantic. You can fit 24 people very comfortably in one yacht. The need for 24 is ridiculous, but it also speaks to the kind of the bubble nature of that level of sport, where these people have massive egos. Everyone around them tells them yes all the time and tells them that they're the most important people to sort of ever trod the surface of the earth. And so, of course, they need to have each one has to have their own yacht. You wouldn't want them to feel anything less than yacht worthy. So I love that kind of story. There's also sort of petty little things, too. There was one of the guys who ultimately got convicted at trial was this Paraguayan Juan Angel Naput, who was head of Paraguay's FA. And then he became president of CONCACAF and a FIFA vice president very briefly before he fell under the under the sword of the U.S. Justice Department. And he was a big rock and roll fan, or is a big rock and roll fan, and loves classic rock. And I remember I actually talked to him once, and he told me that, you know, we talked about Elton John, how much he loved Elton John and things like that. And one of the ways that people who wanted to get his help to corrupt soccer found to bribe him wasn't just money, because he was already a rich man. He came from a rich family. I think his father was very wealthy, and so he inherited a lot of money. So while he cared about money, and it wasn't the driving thing for him. In fact, he was once, someone said they heard him quoted saying, "What's $1 million more or less to me? What do I care about $1 million?" And that was sort of his attitude about cash. But they found other ways to get his influence. So they famously, allegedly gave him tickets to see Paul McCartney play in Buenos Aires at the River Stadium, where River Plate plays. And yeah, that was the way to get his love, was to give him $10,000 VIP tickets to see Paul McCartney. And we saw WhatsApp messages and text messages he sent about the concert and how it was this life-changing experience for him. Kind of a very interesting psychological insight into the way these guys tick.
It surely is. I mean, it's something that just blows your mind. I mean, another individual that, going all the way back to the beginning of the interview, when you were mentioning about Miami and South Florida, I guess in this case, was, I think it was José María Marín, the former president of the CBF over in Brazil. I think he had like a $15 million mansion in Boca Raton. I think it's either him or Marco Polo. Please correct me if I'm wrong, if I got one or the other wrong.
Well, José María Marín, what I know of his properties is he owns a $3 million or $4 million apartment in the Trump Tower. Mm-hmm. And that's where he had been living until he was convicted under house arrest. And that's a very fancy, you know, apartment in the Trump Tower, which, by the way, is where Chuck Blazer also lived.
And his cats, too.
Yeah, well, that's that whole story, that was where that I knew of his housing. I'm not sure about Marco Polo. What I do know is that José Ávila, another Brazilian, bought a $6 million house in on Fisher Island in Miami, Fisher Island, according to my research, is the wealthiest zip code in all of America.
The only way you can get in there is via ferry. It's right. The richest zip code per capita in the United States. Absolutely right.
And so he bought a $6 million condo. It wasn't even a mansion, right? Because I think they're mostly condos there, overlooking the water, overlooking a beach, which I understand is sanded with sand that was brought in from the Bahamas to have it nicer sand. Mm-hmm. So it's sort of this idyllic, perfect thing. And so he spent $6 million on this. And the irony there is that he closed the deal. He signed the deal to close the real estate purchase, and within a week, he was secretly arrested by the IRS and the FBI and forced to cooperate with the U.S. investigation.
The names are incredible. Luis Bedoya was another one. Sergio Jadwe, who was on South Beach on house arrest, apparently, for months and months, and actually probably like almost a year and change, just hanging out. You know, that's what they did during that time. I mean, it's so strange, because after all those individuals get arrested, people are like, well, this is a new FIFA, this is a new CONCACAF, this is a new CONMEBOL. But you're like, wait a second. Nah, so you're telling me that 15, and then if you had the other 7 that were arrested a couple of years later, so those were the only people that were doing anything wrong? I mean, that's something, because not one, you know, I mean, at times people would talk about Issa Hayatou over in Africa. Rarely ever is talked about what goes on in Asia, which, I mean, there's been some mentions at times. But then also you start to hear Angel Maria Villar mentioned quite a bit over in Europe. But why not these individuals as well? Why aren't these being investigated by authorities as intensely? Of course, in the case with Villar, he's already been dealt with.
Yeah, Villar's been he's been arrested and charged in Spain and so there is a slow kind of reckoning, I think, that gets a lot of these people. But to your point, I think there is a question of sort of how far do you go with it. I mean, I think one of the challenges that faces the prosecutors in the U.S. case is, do they just keep this going forever? Because it doesn't seem really to end, right? If you get one person, the next seems to either already have been corrupted or quickly figures out how to be corrupt. And I think that speaks again to the culture of the sport, which is the corruption is so ingrained, what the prosecutors called endemic to the sport, that the people who are waiting in line for these vaunted jobs, the people who want to be the next president of their FA or of the Confederation or whatever it is, part of the reason they want to do it is because they're waiting for their turn to stick their hands in the till. And so as soon as they get the opportunity to take these jobs, they assume that that comes with the money. I mean, going back to Webb, we brought up a few times, one of the stories I learned about him was that even before he became president, when he was campaigning for president, people from traffic approached him and they said, we want to back you to be the CONCACAF president. And, you know, this is a sensitive subject, but just so you know, if you do it, we'd be, you know, we have arrangements where we can make special payments to you in exchange for the rights. And I think they were nervous about having a conversation with him because you don't want to say to the wrong person where, you know, we won't want to corrupt you. You tell that, you know, you tell the wrong honest cop about a corruption, you're going to jail. And so they were terrified of telling him. But instead of being shocked, he said, yeah, of course, I was waiting for someone to ask me when I could get a bribe. Right. And he'd been waiting for that moment. He'd been dreaming of the moment when someone would offer him a bribe. And I think that's part of the problem.
Oh, my God.
You mentioned Asia. I mean, there's interesting signs out there. One of the little known things that came off this case was in May or June of last year, I believe, maybe it was around then, it was announced that a guy named Richard Lai, who was the president of Guam's FA, had pled guilty and was cooperating with the U.S. investigation. Guam, obviously not a big soccer powerhouse. So on that level, not that interesting, except that Guam is part of the AFC, not CONCACAF, the Asia Football Confederation. And it turns out he was a power broker within that confederation and very close to some of the people who ran it. And his cooperation and his guilty plea suggest involvement in deep and long-running corruption schemes over there that seem to touch people like Bin Hammam, who we heard about so many years ago, and other people like Sheikh Ahmad, who is from Kuwait and is a power broker, both in soccer and in Olympics over in Asia. And clearly the indications are that the corruption is just as deep and as widespread there as it is over here in the West.
We could delve in this for hours, Ken. I mean, and I think people will delve into your book, you know, for hours as well because of all the information and all the stories that you have in there. Before we go, I wanted to ask you, as far as, you know, bringing out your crystal ball and seeing how things are going to play out in the future, do you think that there will be more individuals that will fall, or do you think that's going to be it for now? Because, I mean, there's been a lot of people, especially, I mean, having to look at it from a geographical standpoint here in the United States, that a lot of things happened here, but yet there was a lot of people that said, oh, I didn't know. Oh, I never thought about it that way. Oh, really? That's what happened? And this is happening right underneath their noses. What did they become so insular to things that they became just, you know, so or immune, I guess, to the whole concept of bribery and all these other things that were going on that they didn't realize that this was going on? Or was it just that they looked the other way because of convenience?
Huh, I don't know. I mean, I think there was definitely some looking away for convenience's sake. But I think there was also some willful, you know, I don't know if it's willful ignorance or not, but there was ignorance. It's hard to say. I mean, I think that, you know, I think a lot of us who care about the sport would like to see more cleaning up happen. And I think we'd like to see the investigation, you know, reach deep enough to really clean it up for good and to either scare people straight or to just flush out all the people who are just problematic. I think in the crystal ball level, I think where one starts to realize that you hit up against just bureaucratic obstacles and other things, which is that nothing goes forever, no investigation goes forever, and you can't root out everything. And I think that to some degree, I think that the prosecutors or the football gods are happy that other countries have followed America's lead and have started their own investigations, because I think it was unfair to expect the U.S. to shoulder the whole burden forever. So it's heartening, I think, to see that Spain has at least two investigations, that Switzerland has at least two investigations, that Germany and France have their own investigations. It's important that other countries also work on this because, you know, I think, and I think this speaks for a way the Justice Department operates, not just in sports, but in all kinds of international issues, which is They want to be the Justice Department wants to be a leader on these issues, but they don't want to be alone on it. They want to inspire others to get involved as well. So we saw this with a lot of the Swiss banking stuff in the last 10 years or so, particularly around sort of 2009, 2014 time period. There was a lot of crackdown on Swiss banking practices, and part of the job, using, among other things, the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, and part of it was to just immediately rectify problems they saw, but part of it was also to chasten and other countries to get them to pay attention and to launch their own investigations. And a huge amount of the money laundering work that's happened around the world on a lot of different issues stems from that, right? And we've heard about the Panama Papers and that sort of thing, but I don't think any of that would have ever happened if the U.S. Mm-hmm. hadn't gone after HSBC, if it hadn't gone after Credit Suisse, if it hadn't gone after these big banks and said, look, you know, nothing is above the law and nothing is invulnerable. Certainly, there's a risk of overreach. Sometimes the prosecutors go too far, and there's cases where people have criticized them harshly for trying to be the world's policeman. But, you know, I think that in the case of soccer, for example, no one else was doing it. They just weren't. We all knew that soccer had problems. Great investigative journalists for years had written stories, and nothing came out of it. The Swiss even had a years-long case about corruption at that ISL, the original marketing organization behind FIFA that was so corrupt, and nothing came of it. They dropped all the charges. And so the message that was going on over and over again was no one was really going to do anything. And so the U.S. said, well, you know what, we'll do something. And because they did that, others are doing something now. And I'm hopeful that attitude will continue.
Was it fear because of disaffiliation or the risk of disaffiliation? I mean, that was something that Sepp Blatter, especially, he had pretty much hanging over everyone's head. Hey, if you start investigating FIFA, there's a risk that you're going to get, you know, you're going to run the risk of having your FA disaffiliated from FIFA. Was that a fear? I mean, let's be honest. I mean, we haven't mentioned him much. But one of the big reasons we're in the situation, or football's in the reason, in the situation it's in, it's not just Julio Grondona, it was actually Sepp Blatter himself.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I know Blatter. I've interviewed him a few times, mm-hmm. and we communicate periodically. He's one of those guys who is a complicated character because you end up, against your own will, being seduced by his charm and his humor and all that. So it's interesting to talk to him. And I have never personally seen signs of his own corruption. That is to say, I haven't seen signs that he personally financially benefited from bribes. That said, it seems pretty clear that he had an attitude that turning a blind eye to serious problems was okay, right? So, you know, if you let someone else do something corrupt because it benefits you in a political way, well, that's its own kind of corruption, right? And that seems to be Blatter's thing. And certainly he was not afraid of the carrot and stick approach to everything. That would seem to be his motivating political process. And their threats were constant. And the threat over anyone who gave him any trouble, getting in trouble or not going along with the way that he wanted things to happen, led to rebuke. You know, I mean, I was thinking of Harold May Nichols, who was the head of the Chilean FA for many years. He's someone who we learned that was actually pretty clean. I mean, he actually refused bribes, wouldn't take bribes, and thought it was inappropriate. Yet Blatter drummed him out of the game on what seemed like a fairly trumped up excuse to drum him out of the game. And so the message was clear. Like, if you don't do things the way people want, you're gone. I think people were terrified of him. You know, the Brits really wanted the 2010 World Cup. And while they wanted it, some of their best investigative journalists, while they were bidding for it, some of their best investigative journalists were digging up stories about massive corruption within FIFA. Mm-hmm. And what did the Brits do? The government and the FA there said, oh, please don't publish that. Please don't publish those articles. Not now. Please publish them some other time. We wouldn't want for FIFA to punish us with not giving us the World Cup, but mm-hmm. because you published this article. Well, as a journalist, I'm offended by that, right? I mean, you know, news doesn't wait because of the convenience of a soccer organization. And, you know, if the membership due to get into the club is to stifle the truth, like, who wants to be in that club, right? I mean, who wants to go to a party where you have to be corrupt to go into it? And the Brits were basically saying, we're willing to accept the corruption because we want this so bad. And that's really it, right? Everyone wants it so bad. Everyone wants the big prize. Everyone wants to be in the World Cup. Everyone wants to host the World Cup. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, they seem to be willing to do anything to get it. Look, the World Cup is starting soon in Russia. In Russia, in 2018, yeah. Right? Of all places in the world, it's in Russia. Can you believe it? It's a crazy one. Mm-hmm. And we all know that FIFA has had these horrible problems and that probably there's some serious issues about why Russia, of all places, has the World Cup. But you know what? We'll all be tuning in to watch it because we want to watch the soccer because we love the sport and we just can't get enough of it. And that's it. They have the golden goose that everyone wants. And people, yeah.
It's crazy. I mean, dating even back to Germany, everything that happened that came out of that entire bid, even after they got it, you started hearing about all the other, discussions and all the bribes and all the other, gifts that were being offered, here and there and everywhere for Germany to get the 2006 World Cup. I mean, that also as well. I mean, it's sad, but in the end, yeah, we end up, it's the game that we're in love with, and that's pretty much what it comes down to. Ken, I don't want to hold you up anymore. Thank you so much for being on the show. I mean, there were a lot of things that we touched on. There's so many more that we can touch upon even more. How can people contact you? How can they stay in touch with you? What are you going to be doing as far as the book? And again, just one more time to be able to plug the book. Ken's book will be coming out on June the 12th. It's called Red Card, How the U.S. Blew the Whistle on the World's Biggest Sporting Scandal. So how would we be able to contact you? And what are you going to be doing? A book tour or anything like that?
Yeah, so thanks. I'm fairly active on Twitter, as you mentioned earlier. So I encourage anyone who's interested to check me out at Ken Bensinger. That's KenBensinger. And you can see my tweeting in two languages, in English and Spanish, on different soccer matters there. And you can probably find me on Facebook as well if you're so inclined. And then you can, I highly, of course, encourage everyone to pick up a copy of the book, which, as Juan said, will be available June 12th in bookstores. And you can pre-order it now on Amazon or Barnes & Noble or your favorite place, or the audiobook is available at Audible. That would be great, really appreciated. And those of you who get the book, would love you to tell other people that care about the sport about it and, review the book and talk about it in social media. And I love pictures of people with their book and it makes me really happy. So seeing that in Twitter is terrific. If you could add those at me, I'd be pleased as punch. And in terms of book tours, I'm going to do some readings in different places around the country. Bookstores who are listening to this podcast, please invite me. I'm doing events in Los Angeles, Seattle, and Portland so far, as well as a launch party in New York City. Mm-hmm. Would love an excuse to come to a place like Miami or Washington, D.C., or other places where that care about the sport. So I'm open for business and eager to get a chance to talk about the book more.
Well, let me see what I can do. I'd love to, man. You know what? I'd love to be able to see how we can bring you to Miami. I mean, you always want an excuse. Well, let me give you one, right? You don't even have to make one up yourself. I'll see what we can do to bring you down here to do one, maybe even two, different.
It'd be great. I have lots of friends in Miami. I'll get an audience. It'll be a ton of fun. And, the other shot I'd like to add is that the book's also coming out in different parts of the world and in different languages. So if those of you who have friends in the UK, the book will be available there as well. And it's going to be in Latin America under the title Tarjeta Roja. It's going to be in Brazil and Portugal, Cartão Vermelho, and it's going to be in the Netherlands, Italy, and a few other places. So it's going to be all over the place, and I'm really excited about it. It was a lot of work, but I think I'm telling a story that just hasn't been told before. And I guess before we go, one thing we haven't had a chance to talk about is I want to take my hat off to the incredible work the prosecutors and the investigators did in this case. And yes. One character who I think deserves a lot of love, and I hope people talk about it, is an IRS agent named Steve Berryman, who is based out here in California, made the case. There's no question there's no case without Steve Berryman, who is a brilliant IRS agent, maybe one of the best special agents in the entire country, and also a devoted lifelong soccer fan, huge Liverpool supporter. So he's still licking his wounds over the Champions League final.
If I were to have him on the show, I'd wait a couple of weeks just to be able to, get back to, a good mindset before.
I think you should. I think it's a little rough for him right now, but truly an incredible hero in this case, and someone who did this because he loves the game so much. So I hope people are talking about Steve Berryman as a Hall of Fame hero to the sport in the future.
Perfect. Sounds good. Ken, again, thank you so much for being on the show, and definitely, you know what? I'm going to make sure that you're down here in Miami. Where? I don't know. I have a couple of places in mind. You might like them. And definitely you'll enjoy being down here, getting questions from audience members and even fellow journalists that come in here. Because obviously, as we mentioned during this interview, Miami was one of the epicenters of your book, or of the topic that you cover in your book, better yet. And again, looking forward to reading it. And if I don't read it, I'll most likely get it while I'm working on the World Cup and listening to. Do you narrate the book, or is somebody else?
No, they picked someone else. You heard me cough a few times. I'm no good at that kind of thing. So they got a pro to do it. So
okay.
So but he's good. They gave me a list of them, and I thought the guy they chose has a nice, clear, ringing voice. So hopefully that'll be enjoyable.
Excellent. Well, I hope it does your book justice. Best of luck to you. And again, thank you so much for being on Beyond the Pitch, Ken. It's been a great pleasure.
Oh, it's been a pleasure of mine, and I hope we get a chance to talk again soon, Juan.